This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. We are back for week two of the season seven. I am Rob Calder, the coach development coordinator at Basketball Victoria. With me, the man who loves his Black Cats and not of the Allens variety, Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome, Coops.
Awesome to be back. Good to see you guys.
And the woman who potentially stopped a little bit of a kidnapping situation at lunch, Zoe Carr. Welcome back to the pod.
That's going to need context, but thanks for having me.
Yeah, so the context is we went and grabbed lunch at our trusty little Subway around the corner, and as we exited the vehicle, heard this banging from the back of a very suspicious-looking van. Coops and I heard it and thought, yeah, but if there's only one Subway cookie left, we don't want that going to someone else. So continue to walk in the same direction. Zoe dove on the grenade straight away, went and opened the back of the van, and turns out the trusty bread delivery driver managed to lock himself in the back of it.
So, I mean, I 100% saved his life.
Like, no, that without happened. Question. Oh, yeah. Without question. I was just really hopeful it wasn't going to be a Leslie Chow moment as he just popped out of the boot. So it certainly worked out well in that space. But, coaches, we do thank you for your interaction on the socials over the last week as well with the podcast being back. It is always great to read that people are listening and things that they want to hear as well. The interaction has been brilliant, especially when Jared Potter goes and puts up a lovely little meme that will be used in a variety of situations with my coaching over the next few years, I would suggest as well. So any topics or anything you want to discuss on the podcast, we are always happy to hear them. Please just shoot them through by all means on the email if you want. You can get Coops on Twitter if you want to go down that path, which is?
Coach NCB.
Excellent. You can get Zoe on Twitter.
At ZoeCar85.
And you can get me at Rob Coulter. You guys have smashed that because Ash and Jenny never knew it. And I don't think Bestie's even on Twitter. So between the lot of it, you're probably best off getting one of the three of us. So happy to have coaches send any questions they possibly can or topics they want to hear about. We did have a couple come through during the week, which we'll get on to researching over the next couple of weeks. We could potentially look at some calling from some coaches from around the place. We'll do a mailbag at some point down the road as well. So the more interaction we get in that space, the better it will be, hopefully, to deliver content that you can use with your coaching, which is always a big thing. So always appreciate any likes, shares, subscriptions, listens, ratings, and reviews. That would be fantastic. So we touched on the Black Cats, Coops. want to give us a little bit of a Sunderland FC update?
Heartbreaking tie on the weekend, which kind of ruined my Sunday. But overall, we're undefeated in the championship, so it's still exciting times.
So since the last pod, you have been promoted.
We have been promoted. I know everybody is gasping listening to this, but we're up. We're in the championship. We're playing some decent football. So, only one day ruined thus far.
Excellent. That's a good result. I'm hoping for another season of Sunderland until I die. I know you have, Zoe, but have you caught any of the Arsenal All or Nothing to this point?
Yeah, I'm one episode in and loving it. Just on the back of obviously watching the Man City All or Nothing a few times and the differences and the similarities between Guardiola and Arteta, the difference in obvious start to the season and how he's dealing with the adversity. It's a really enjoyable watch and something I would recommend for coaches.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this might be a Jared Potter specialty. We might see if we can hook him up with a coach for maybe a preseason or one of our state teams or something like that and see if we can get a little bit of a BV doco going about what coaches actually go through when they coach these types of teams. So I think it'll be actually a super interesting one.
Absolutely.
For a lot of people, and it's daunting having been mic'd up as we're sitting here with three microphones in front of our faces. Like, you never really know when you're going to say something. You go, oh, we may have to retract that. But I think it'll actually be a really interesting one just to hear coaches go through their day-to-day, like being that they're not full-time employed coaches. They still have to try and live and work and those types of things. I think it'll be a really interesting space to jump into. So what we are talking today is about in-game coaching situations. So we do hit that pointy time of the year where finals have kicked off. So a lot of our big V teams are into grand finals or have played their grand finals. Our VJBL competition that is about to start their grand or their final series. So we are looking at what coaches can actually control in-game, how they can make some adjustments that potentially gives their teams a chance when it's this time of year. So we do talk a lot about player development, which is really the forefront, I think, of all coaching. We want to make our players better. We want to give them the situations and the skill sets that they can go and be their best. But this one is purely a coaching space. So we are aware that a lot of this work should really be done over the course of a season. This is not just I've made finals. How good's this? Let's throw out that playbook and let's bring in this new one that I've had sitting on the shelf for finals. This is going to be how much can you actually adjust at this time of year. So, I suppose the first little part of this is how much can coaches actually influence the outcome of a game during a game.
Definitely has a lot to do with the preparation and your athletes. I think a way of potentially reframing that is how much can they try? And, you know, execution's obviously going to come down to a variety of factors. But at the end of the day, you know, you don't want to be walking away from a game, especially a finals game, without making absolutely every effort to impact the game from the sideline as much as possible. And so, like for me, I know that I'm really open to trying new things, thinking outside the box, you know, constantly trying to impact the game as much as possible. You know, for that reason, though, I want to make sure that I've done everything that I can. So, yeah, I would always recommend to every coach to try and find a variety of ways of imposing themselves on the game. And then at the end of the day, if it doesn't come off, it doesn't come off, and you can evaluate, but you got to try.
Yep. What about you, Zoe? Any different? Like, how many times have you felt in a game, I didn't do enough in that space, or I coached that one really well, and maybe the results still didn't go your way?
Yeah, so I've definitely walked away from games saying I should have done this. I think we all do. I should have done, you know, A instead of B or whatever it might be. I think our impact as coaches in games, to be honest, it's kind of like selection, right? So, you know, you can't win a gold medal in selection, but you can lose it. I don't think as coaches we can actually win the game for them, but we can lose it with decisions that we make. So I think I like to try and impact the game as much as I can, but more so with reduced errors. So, you know, I can see something's either not working or on the brink of not working. I'll make an adjustment, whether it be a defensive or offensive adjustment or a sub or call a timeout or whatever that might be. But I'm very big on trying to control momentum and control tempo. And, you know, I use my timeouts and my subs and my adjustments, especially defensively, to do that.
So I would suggest that all three of us have been in this space a fair bit, that we use a lot of small-sided games at our training sessions, a lot of competitive type things, in the hope that we will obviously see it in a game situation. Whether it plays out that way, who really knows? But we are all in that space. So I suppose with the small-sided games and the teaching games for understanding and those types of things, like, we are trying to empower our players to make decisions and to almost make us as coaches a little bit redundant, because they've seen that situation before, they've gone about it before. Are you saying in that space, Zoe, that you're probably more likely to intervene because it's finals, or would it change how you coach in a finals versus a regular season game?
I'd like to think not. Yep. I really would. Like, I'd like to be able to say that the occasion would play no part and I'd just coach the way I coach. I suppose that's probably something I need to look back on and see if that was the case for the times that I was in finals. I think it can, the pressure of the occasion can definitely, whilst I'm just doing a quick think now, I think it definitely changed how I coached, more so from a, not so much from an adjustment and intervention point of view, but probably more so from an emotional point of view. So things annoyed me more than they probably should have, influences that I can't control, I probably spent too much time on or thinking about instead of just getting on to the next one, and the only thing I could put that down to was the fact it was a final. So yeah, I think it definitely, long story short, definitely did change the way I coached, and probably something I've got to get better at.
Yep. Is there anything you do in that sort of space, Coops, to sort of regulate yourself a little bit? Because obviously we all know we have those swings and roundabouts of just our emotional state, and, you know, let's face it, we all like winning games. Mm. It is one of those areas that, as much as we're in this for development, we enjoy the actual, the coaching and the winning and the losing, and, well, not so much the losing, but obviously the ability to win and lose. Is there anything you do in that space to just sort of make yourself a little calmer pre-game?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big advocate for developing mental skills, obviously through our players, but in terms of role modelling, it's something that's important to me. So breath work is a big one. I like cues. Like, I got a wristband. I'm wearing it right now. It says focus on the positive. You know, something that I'd struggled to do in the past, in that teacher brain, coach brain, you know, hunting the negative, trying to fix things. You know, can I focus more on the positive? Can I keep my what's next mentality? Can I use that phrase? So, yeah, so some cue words, some resets, some breathing. Even having some conversations with my assistant coaches around, hey guys, you know me, if you see me getting wound up, you know, come and give me a tap on the shoulder or say, you know, remind me of this or that. And so, yeah, no, I'm trying to be as conscious of those things to keep me as even keel on the sidelines as possible.
I think the last wristband I wore was one of those Livestrong ones that Lance Armstrong promoted out there, which may not have gone fantastically in hindsight. He managed to inspire, you know, Peter LaFleur onto a dodgeball winning championship. So, you know, hey, we all have
average
our
Joe's.
Yeah, we all have our moments.
You're killing it today, man. Yeah. Hangover, dodgeball, like, we're flying.
How many more can we get in?
We'll see how this plays out. But if we start getting American Pie references, it may have gone too far. Yeah. Like, we'll see how we go before that point. But I think that is a really important part. For a lot of our coaches out there, they aren't professional coaches. So you can have those moments where, like, the pro coaches might be on a bus with someone and those types of things where they can really shut off everything. Like, they are completely focused on what's going on, whereas a lot of our coaches out there, they're driving the games. Like, they get stuck on the lights on Warrigal Road, and it's like, oh, again, I've had to leave 3.5 hours early to get to my game, and now I've copped 3 red lights in a row. Like, someone cuts them off. So the ability to regulate and try and find a way that pre-game you are balanced and you are very emotionally calm, I think is vitally important. And that goes from literally the drive to the game to what you're like in the stadium. Like, do you go and hang with your team beforehand? Are you a little bit removed from them? Like, I know with me, like, my usual thing is, do we have all 10 players? Like, it's that kind of thing. It's like, where is my team? All those types of things. Like, you go and do your pre-game chat, and it's like, well, I can only find 6 of my kids. But it's that organisation stuff beforehand to make sure that you do stay calm throughout. You don't let yourself get riled up before a game. You try and find a way to be fairly balanced.
Well, and then add to that as well, you know, especially our coaches that are hopefully listening to this, you know, there are other influences. You could have a problem parent, you could have a problem athlete, you could have, you know, all these other things that add levels of anxiety that you've got to then try and manage as well. Especially something early in my coaching that I kind of struggled with, but I'm better at now is, you know, if there is a problem parent, about separating that out from the athlete. That's something that's really important. But that's, again, that's just another layer of things that our coaches that aren't full-time have to try and manage, and then coach a game, staying as neutral as possible.
Yeah, just that separating out too, I think that's really important also when you're talking about removing self-worth from winning. And we talk a lot to our athletes about, you know, they're not basketballers, they're young people who play basketball, and their worth or their self-worth isn't tied up in their performance. I think we need to remember that as coaches, and I'm really bad at that. If I lose, I think I'm a loser, you know, and I'm getting wound up in those games where I'm, you know, I've lost a lot in my last couple of years. Most people would know if they follow senior basketball just from the situation. But yeah, that was really something difficult to get through, but something I'm also working on is trying to separate those two things.
But while you lost a lot, you probably learned the most.
100%.
Yeah.
And that is difficult because you'll go through that during the season as well. Like, this isn't exclusive to finals or anything like that. That is literally, that could just be a random Saturday night as you walk into your gym. Like, you just might have had a rough week at work, you know, family problems or whatever else has been going on, or you take on the burden of someone else's problems that you're trying to help through that. And then you have to put all of that aside for an hour and a half and think with this clear mind about how am I going to get this done, or how are we going to try and put our kids in a situation or your team in a situation where they can perform at their best, knowing that whilst you've had that sort of stuff going on, they've probably had, you know, that tenfold because they go to school or they work as well or they have families on the side. There's just so much to take into account. So I think you bang on the money. We do have to remove the winning as to is this successful or not, because there are times, and to be fair, I can probably count them on one hand, where I feel like, you know, I coached the perfect game. Like, I think it was as close as you can possibly get and still lost. Like, I rolled everything out I could possibly could there. Like, my change-ups were good, my subbing patterns were good, and we still lost to, you know, sometimes a worse team. Yep. But it just happened.
Yep.
There's not much you can do about it.
My first year in Siebel was 100% that. I think we only won 8 games for the year. A lot of honourable losses. But walking away from those games where we lost, you know, and we're young and inexperienced and we're taking it to these teams that are stacked, and you know, it's that I found myself getting caught in the, I was so proud of them and so happy for the fact that, you know, the evolution that we're making to even be able to take it to these teams. And then on the other side going, oh, if we, you know, if we just made that layup, that would have changed everything, or, you know, and sort of getting stuck of the what if sort of bandwagon, I guess, and trying to make sure I stayed on that positive. That's pretty much all that got me through the year, I think.
And it's a tough car ride home. Yes. Like, let's face it, like even the one that's just around the corner from where you live, you still got to replay that game a lot in your head. So whilst we've talked a little bit doom and gloom in a lot of ways, but there are some in-game coaching adjustments so that we can potentially look at to try and help influence our team. So normally we talk about the development side of things, which is great, but we just get to talk a little bit of X's and O's today, which is kind of fun. Like, we don't often get to do this, so it is kind of nice to sit in that situation. So look at the defensive side of the ball to start off with. I see this a lot on a Friday night, that if you go on a little bit of a run, you can bet your bottom dollar that the next two couple of possessions will be a 2-3 zone of some sort. Like, that seems to be the default change-up for everyone, and we'll probably talk about this in a couple of weeks' time, Coots, when we jump on about the AJCs that have been on this year as well. That was almost the default setting for every team, that, geez, if things are starting to look a little bit bleak, we'll go to a zone. So if you are of that ilk and you want to go to – and there are times where you would absolutely zone because that is the right call to make, that's not a problem at all. Is there anything else you would look at doing instead of zoning in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, a lot of X's and O's discussion revolve around it depends. So I'll just preface everything that I'm saying today, I'm sure you guys are saying, by it depends. But being a little bit more in-depth in your analysis around what is going on, you know, who's hurting us, where are they hurting us from, and can we be a little bit more specific about what we want to take away and how we want to disrupt or impact the game. You know, we saw some really fun junk defenses from Nick Nurse and the Toronto Raptors a couple of years ago, you know, against the Warriors with some box and one. You know, can you get a little bit more creative in the way that you want to impact the defensive end? Also, you know, how does that pertain to, you know, have you got an elite defender? Is it a simple matchup change that could have the same result rather than just going back to something as passive as a 2-3 zone? You know, can you get up the floor? Can you do a variety of things that are going to be, just that little bit more creative and maybe impactful, especially when you think about what do most people have in their bag of tricks? A pretty decent 2-3 zone offense. So it's not necessarily something that's going to impact the game the way that you want it to. So if you have the luxury of having an assistant coach, obviously there's some discussions that you'd like to have, you know, pre-game or maybe in one of those breaks around what you have. But that would be my first port of call is who's hurting us, where are they hurting us from, and can we be a little bit more creative?
Yep. I think, you've hit on probably my next part of this is this an action you're losing to or being hurt by, or is this a player?
Mm.
Because they're not necessarily the same problem.
Yeah.
Like, it's trying to find the balance between the two.
And switching to the 2-3 zone is basically trying to, especially if it's a player, is basically trying to stop them at the last line. Can you disrupt them earlier? So can you get up the floor? Can you change a coverage on your on ball before that player gets the ball, or, you know, anything like that? Can you be more disruptive rather than going back into that 2-3 zone and sort of waiting for them to come to you? You know, get it before the ball's in their hands, sort of thing. So, yeah, there's a million and one things you could do, but, you know, my sort of change up, I guess, I prefer to be disruptive earlier. So don't allow them to either the action or the player that's hurting us.
Do you fear that if you potentially speed that up, it's going to get worse? Like, because I think that's where a lot of teams come into a zone. It's like, we'll try and disrupt this for the meantime in the hope that they maybe cool off a little bit and that will allow us to get back in the game. So you are suggesting in that space, rather than going passive, go more aggressive.
Yeah, so, and it can. My thought would be, especially if it's a player that's hurting us, make somebody else beat us. So this particular player's obviously got the ability to put the team on their back and win them the game. So let's take them out of the game and see if anybody else has got the ability to step up. Now, if they do, now we've got to make an additional adjustment. But we've at least, you know, what you find sometimes if it's a player that's hurting and you take them and you're more aggressive, you take them out of the game to the point where they're either not catching it where they want to or not catching it at all, you start to get antsy and wanting to get your shots and wanting to get your touches and those sort of things. And now the uncontested catch and shoot now becomes a forced drive or a forced something outside of their offense, and it doesn't come as simple as it, you know, has been throughout the game. So I think also something we need to get okay with as coaches, you can't take everything away defensively. What are you willing to lose to?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're playing a team that is averaging, you know, 12% from the three-point line and they beat you from the three-point line, basketball gods aren't on your side that day. You force them into something that doesn't work for them. Now, it is what it is. You've got to find what you're comfortable losing to and then stick to that. So obviously you want to make some adjustments. You know, I think we had a perfect example, Rob, of a player. I can't remember who it was, but they weren't a shooter, but stuck three threes on us. So all of a sudden it's like, okay, instead of stepping off, now we've at least got to carry a hand. You can make those adjustments, but, you know, still stay with, you know, you don't want to be going, or I believe, sorry, you don't want to be going machine gun here. You know, if you've come into the game and said, okay, we're willing to lose from the three-point line because this team is not a three-point shooting team, and they start dropping, they hit two threes in a row, stay calm and stay with it, because sometimes that can work in your favor. Because as soon as they hit those two, now all of a sudden it's, they want another one, they want another one, they want another one, and that percentage goes down. So, you know, sometimes it's about just staying calm with your and giving your process enough time to actually show if it's working.
Yeah, so the athlete was Joy Burke, and we said lay off a little bit on the three because she's more a driver than she is a shooter. Went three from three from the three-point line, and very quickly the scout changed. And I remember I got the blame for it. It's like, hey, you had on the scout, she's not a shooter. And it's like, well, after she stuck her third, feel free to just maybe adjust the scout a little bit and throw a hand up there next time you close out. So when we played her 6 weeks later, the scout had changed a little bit.
Shout out to my girl, Joy Blair.
Yeah.
Exactly, like the Coops Ballarat alum out there. But yeah, like there are times where you have to change a scout. You can go in with the best plans in the world, but sometimes it just doesn't work for whatever reason. Like, you know,
but what I mean is, like, if you've gone in saying, make them beat us from the three, give it a chance to work, and then, you know, you don't then go, okay, we're going to allow them to have layups, like, because that's just going to play into what they're comfortable with. And if they've something that doesn't work for them normally is working, you cannot afford to give them something that they are comfortable in.
Yeah, you're making me think of a practical example. You know, Andre Lemanis, both with the Boomers and with Brisbane before he left, they would use what's called a hit or hits, which was basically that early double team. They used a lot late clock, and the idea was that, you know, let's go be disruptive, let's send that other guy to the ball. We understand we're leaving someone open, but let's make them uncomfortable. Mm. Let's make them do something that they don't necessarily want to do, or go quicker on the clock. We understand we're potentially going to get scored on, but we're impacting the game in that way. And I think that's a good one for anybody that, you know, likes to get into film and see it being done at the top level.
Yeah, I use that a lot, late clock.
Mm. Yeah,
like
same.
In particular when like teams are walking up trying to get that last shot, just that quick double, go and try and get it out of their hands and speed that up a little bit. And it's amazing how many times you get a layup out
strike
of it.
Rate.
Yep. It is strike incredibly
rate is huge.
Good. Grant, you probably shouldn't leave the open shooter to go and do it. Like, you've got to be a little bit more strategic than that about who you go and help off to go and get your double. But it is something that can be really helpful. And, you know, I found pound for pound, that's probably the most impactful thing I've had in games in those situations.
And again, though, if you do get scored on in something like that, you have to be okay with it if that's your rule. If you've called hit or your rule is to hit late clock, they go do it and, you know, good job offense. They've come up with a layup or whatever it might be. That's okay. That's you've got to be okay with that. You can't put rules, and this is something I've found with coaches and coaching in general, is sometimes rules go in, and then it's the athlete's fault when it doesn't work. And you've just got to be content with it, because anytime you go aggressive, you're opening something up. And if offense is good enough to find whatever that is, you know, good for them. What you're trying to do is challenge them to make those quick decisions. If you're going to be an aggressive defensive coach, to make those quick decisions for 40 minutes or 32 minutes or, you know, whatever it is. And that's tough. Like, because obviously the game is physically demanding, but the reason I like to be more of an aggressive sort of defensive coach is it's mentally draining to be having to consistently make forced decisions repeatedly, you know, for 40 odd minutes. So, yeah, I suppose that's just something you've got to be content with when your rule doesn't work.
Yeah, the other thing we've seen a little bit is, in particular, late game situation, ball gets advanced, comes in from the sideline, it's have two defenders on the ball. And I must admit, I coached an under-12 boys team maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, and I had the perfect opportunity to do this, and I chickened out. Like, it's it was a tight game. It was one that I kind of wanted to win, and the kids certainly wanted to win. And I thought, hey, this would be the best time to really experiment and see if this works. Even I couldn't do it. Like, and I am like the nutty professor of all things and trying to do weird stuff. I couldn't do it. Yeah. So you do have to pick your poison a little bit. You have to be prepared that if this goes wrong,
it's on you.
It's like, on you, and I wasn't prepared for that.
Yep.
And similar, I'm not prepared to bring two players to potentially put their hands over the sideline when a ref has just said, don't put your hands over the sideline. There's now 4 hands that can potentially go over that sideline. You bet your bottom dollar one of them is going over that thing and tech foul happens. So there's a lot of different things with that. I mean, Coos, you spoke about the zone as well, but that most offensive teams will have something against the zone. So maybe like a 2-3 zone isn't the best option in that space. Maybe you can change up to a 3-2 or a 1-3-1 or a bit of a slider zone or, you know, man one side zone, the other, those types of things, depending on where the ball goes. So,
but it's not, we're not sitting here saying you can't zone.
No, not at all.
It's definitely not that. I think the frustration for a lot of coaches is watching games that are end-to-end zone the whole time. You know, zones to me should be a change-up. And it should be, you know, a few possessions and then get into something else. And again, because defensively I like to keep the offense guessing, so I don't like them to get comfortable with anything. So as soon as I get a inkling that they're starting to be comfortable and start to pick apart either the zone or whatever it is, we're out of it. And we go to something else and that allows me to then bring it back later if I need it in the crunch time. So we're definitely not saying you can't zone, but yeah, it's just that you know, 40 minutes or 32 minutes or whatever it is of zone that, you know, it's not doing anything for anybody, and it's not doing anything, I don't believe, for coaches as well. You know, try things, push yourself out and, you know, have a look at a different kind of D, or, you know, and yeah, it might cost you a game or you know, it might cost you a quarter or whatever, but the things you start to – when you don't have that automatic default of I'm just going to go back to a 2-3 zone, now you've got to coach more, and that's actually a lot more fun.
Coos, would you ever try something defensively in a game that you haven't practiced?
Yeah, I would. It's interesting you bring that up because I'd kind of gone around on that a few times, having – you know, enjoying being a student of the game, having heard some pretty memorable coaches talk about that they're not comfortable in putting something in a game that they hadn't practiced. But then through my own experiences have found that personally I'm more willing to do it, and I enjoy doing it because I love the chess game. You know, on the back of what Zoe's talking about, is I love that opportunity to go against that other coach down the other end and make those decisions and have some fun with it. And again, it kind of comes back to where we started the pod, that I want to keep throwing everything that I can at the game. If it doesn't work, doesn't work. But I would happily try a defense that we hadn't done before. I would try an offense. I would do my best to simplify and put the best person in the best position to succeed. So it's not like I'm just throwing something out there and kind of hoping that it sticks. I do have a thought process and try to instill it with the best detail that I can. But yeah, short answer is yeah, I'm always happy to try something funky.
Yeah, definitely. I remember a game we had a few years ago, Zoe, where we thought we had a pretty good matchup for Lauren Nicholson. You know, a lot of points in the first quarter would potentially suggest differently. And similar deal. Like, we threw everything. Like, we went like play it straight up to these are the rules on the on balls, to no trap catch at all, trap on the first catch, to box and one, to triangle and two, where two were on her. It didn't matter. She still had 40-something. So it's like we hadn't trained for those situations where it's like we're going to go triangle and two and these are the rotations. But, I mean, it was senior basketball, so it's a little bit easier in that space where they've probably had a little bit of exposure to that too. But you can throw everything at it, but I would rather lose the game and have her having 42 knowing that, hey, there's nothing else we could have done at this point. Like,
yeah, totally.
The
right.
only answer at this point was the whole Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing with like a crowbar. Like, it was the only thing stopping her that night. Yeah, it was crazy.
She was fantastic.
So it is that sort of thing where you want to give yourself a little bit of a chance and give yourself, you know, the opportunity to say, well, look, I did what I could do. I can't do much more in that space. You don't want to die wondering as you walk out of that thing. It's like, well, we had a crack.
Yeah.
And you know what? They lost, or we lost in that situation. But next time through, okay, can we get a better plan? Can we prepare for this a little bit better at our training sessions? Like, there's just ways. And so I think the defensive end, I think that's where you actually have the most fun, or it's where I have the most fun personally. Like, I love offense, and I think every coach kind of has that inclination towards it. I'm probably the other way. I love the defensive stuff. I want to be a little bit junky. I want to try and make things as annoying as possible. Like, I'm an annoying person by nature. So that's how I coach as well. I try and be as annoying as possible.
Can confirm.
Yeah, no need to nod your head on that one, Zoe. Like, it's, I get where we're at on that. So it is one of those areas where try and come up with a plan. But if you have the opportunity to put it in at practice, put it in at practice. Yep. Like, at least expose your players to it a little bit. I think that can make a massive difference on the defensive end. So
I think so too. If you put something in that you haven't practiced before in a game at your next practice, then just touch on it. Doesn't have to be, you know, 15, 20 minutes of your session, but just touch on it. So, again, you're following it up, but so it doesn't just come across as, oh, I've just thrown something at you and that's it. You know, it can then be something that you might go back to at a different time, or depending on how it's, I suppose, gone for you in the game. But just touch on it, so then even if it has been unsuccessful, you're helping them with how to make it successful, and it just adds to their game.
Great minds think alike. You beat me to it. It was the evaluation process, and something I really enjoy. Alan Keane, for anybody that doesn't listen to him or get into his stuff, I highly recommend it. And one of the biggest things that he talks about is that evaluation process. And absolutely, if you try something new or late game scenarios, we want to continue to go through that review process and help the players understand why. Also, go back to our decision-making process. What was the spark? Why did it work? Why didn't it? Do we now bring this into our system? Is this something that we can use going forward? So I definitely recommend all the coaches listening out there, try and get more involved in that evaluation process on a regular basis.
Yep. The 80-20 thing is what I default back to a lot. 80% of the time, this is going to be what we're doing. But 20% of the time, things just go a little bit awry and we might change for whatever reason. And I think we were having this conversation the other day, Zoe, like, switching defense probably shouldn't be your default defense. It can be a great change up, but it probably shouldn't be the default. You probably need to be push one way or guard the on ball this way. Like, the default, find something else. Your switch is your bailout at the end. Like, if nothing else is working, and there are plenty of times where that gets to that point, then go to your switching stuff, because you've always got that up your sleeve, because eventually that just becomes accountability. Stay in front of the ball. Like, that's kind of, like, if you just stay in front of it, all the other problems go away. So that's just something to take into consideration for coaches, that 80-20. Obviously, you can't zone in 12s and 14s. For those of you considering doing that, please don't. Again, I spoke about it last week. I don't need my emails blown up on a Monday morning by Warren Brown. Find something else. We'll look at the offensive side of the ball. Okay, so I would suggest most teams have probably got their structures in place by now. If you're going to introduce anything new for your group, I would probably go down the path of maybe a slight adjustment to what you already do rather than a whole new set in that space, because, like, let's face it, it probably takes most teams 4 to 6 weeks to really drill down an offensive structure that they're comfortable with, they understand reads in, they know what's going on in. So putting something in now probably isn't going to be successful. Like, if you have much experience in sort of trying to find something new for your group groups?
Kind of following the same thought, I would prefer to add a wrinkle to an alignment that we already have. Obviously, less teaching, more familiarity by the group in terms of, you know, how we're structured, how we're setting up. Also, a little bit more difficult to scout, obviously, for those playing up at that next level. If you're starting in the same alignment, we can trick the opposition. They think we're running something else. That's obviously a bonus. But going back to what you were talking about earlier, especially with the small-sided games and how we're preparing, for me it's very much about the read and trying to build a toolbox around, you know, what do I have in place when I see this? And so for me, when I'm coaching, it's way more structured around, hey, they're switching, so we're doing this. Or, hey, we're going to run this action to get us to middle pick, and middle pick they're in drops coverage, so we're going to do this. And more trying to help the athletes identify what the defense is so they can make better and quicker decisions that are hopefully more effective on the offensive end rather than just drawing up new play after new play after new play.
So is that something you'd look at in a game, is running a certain action early on to work out what the other team is doing defensively?
Yeah, so I would look at, obviously, if we've played them, they're in the business end of their season, so they've probably played these teams before, the teams they're coming up against now. So I would look at how they guarded me last time and our action and obviously be ready for that. I'm similar to both of you of I'd only like to add wrinkles rather than full new sets. And that'd be based on how teams are looking to guard our action. So, you know, if they're looking to switch, now it might be if there's a pin down and they switch that, then guard comes off, gets it, engages the big and then draws the big out. We dive the big on the rim, lift the weak side big, you know, all that sort of stuff. So those little wrinkles would be what I'd be looking to do to try them, force them back into, I guess, standard defense, you know. So if they're trying something funky, I'd try and attack that and force them back into what we're used to seeing. Mm. So, yeah, and I don't like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, like I was sort of saying before. So if something's not working, you know, obviously we want to try and everyone has more than one offense. So you want to try and find what works. But, you know, I'm a big believer in fix what you've got rather than throw it out and add to it, because that just becomes just overwhelming for your athletes. So find a way to adjust what you've got to suit what you need. You know, I think for any VJBL coach out there at the moment looking to sort of start and head into finals and things like that, you know, you have to be able to have something to attack going under on ball screens. You have to have something to be able to attack traps, like presses and traps and those sort of full court traps, and obviously the 2-3 zone that we've spoken about. I'll also use, from an offensive perspective, the offensive rebound as well as a way to, you know, if they are going to go back to a 2-3 zone, that's really difficult to box out from. So now it's, okay, we're going to shoot the ball, but I might have four attack the basket rather than the 3-2 or, you know, 2-3 or whatever sort of alignment that we normally have. So using that as well, you know, you see anytime you get layups or anytime you get offensive boards and putbacks, defenses will change. So, yeah, I try and, I suppose, that's a really long-winded answer, I apologise, but, yeah, I try and use those sort of things. So it's not just about the actual offence itself, it's about using the other things around the offence to help us.
Yeah, I all those examples I thought were fantastic and immediately made me think of my strategy card. And just something, and not to hopefully step on a question for later, Rob, because I'm sure you had that one loaded up.
Yes, I did, but it's okay, Coops. We'll go off on your tangent first, mate. It's fine.
Oh, just because everything that Zoe was saying, I'm like, yep, 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 yep. And then it immediately made me think of my strategy card and how much I value having that with me throughout the game and how I lay that out in terms of, you know, I want to have, I have kind of tabled at the top my reads. Okay, what we're going to do, this against this, this against this. Then I've got some more diagram based stuff maybe late game, and I try and use that resource to give myself every opportunity to have something up my sleeve that I'm potentially not going to remember as I as I get longer in the tooth and a little bit grayer in the beard.
No. Well, so from an actual X's and O's point of view, I guess throwing this one out there. Teams are going under the on-ball screen. You're shooting poorly from the three. What do you do?
Mm. I would try and slip out of that screen as quickly as you can and be a little bit of a, I don't want to say a moving screen as such, but try and get out of that action and try and disrupt that as best you possibly can. Because I think post-touch is a great way to do that. The teams that go under tend not to guard a reversal pass and big dive overly well, because it gets really disjointed about actually am I guarding the diver or are you guarding the diver? I'm going under it regardless. So I think that's a fairly easy way of just, okay, you're having a bad shooting night. And I mean, we can touch on the old shooter's mentality as to when do you go away from it? Are you still going to make the next shot? But for mine, there are still ways to get good looks out of that.
Yep.
But the biggest killer, I think, and I can say this as the least adept shooter in the room, now that Jared Potter's left, that you know, if I'm having a bad shooting night and I refuse point blank to shoot the ball, I'm hurting my team just as much as if I take a bad shot by not shooting the right shot. And I know I've said shot a lot of times in a very small amount of time there, so I do apologise. But sometimes that is just as detrimental to your group. So as much as you might be having a bad shooting night, if that's still the right shot to take, there's an expectation in my groups that you still shoot that. Again, long-winded answer to your question on that one. What would you do, Coops?
I'm a big fan of the twist.
Yep.
So to twist and rescreen, try and bring the guard back off that second ball screen and maybe get a little bit deeper in the paint, maybe that improvement in range or that little bit deeper in terms of causing a defensive reaction might trigger something. That would be plan A. I don't mind a stop and go either, something that's probably a little bit more aligned to younger age groups if they're using a ball screen, is just that ability for the guard to get behind the screen, pause, have that defender pause, and then really use a really good change of pace to blow out of there and maybe create a split that way. So they're just a couple of things that off the top of my head.
Yep. What would you do?
I'd go into a dribble handoff.
Yep.
I think it's hard to go underneath. I mean, you can go underneath, but you're with – I'd set up for the person with that is entering the dribble handoff as somebody who can turn the corner. Because if you're going underneath that, driving on the heels of the player going underneath is tough to guard. So having the ball already to the floor, which is obviously going to be of comfort because we're not shooting well from the three-point line, I think would be helpful. So look to turn have the big keep and turn – or the dribbler turn the corner and attack. And then obviously – I hope no referees are listening. It is easier to be almost like a moving screen off dribble handoff, so that then, you know, you can hand off and then roll into the player a lot easier and you're more likely to get away with it as they're going underneath the screen as you are in a set on-ball screen.
I think the key point, and we've all probably touched on in our own ways in this, is your players have to be able to make the read. And that's it. Like, we can't give them all the answers. Mm. And like I say this in every coaching course I present, by the time we as coaches see something, process it, verbalise it, player hears it amongst all the other noise that's going on, process that and then work out what to do, the situation's probably changed. So we don't really have that position to be able to say, hey, this every time one of our players touches the ball. So the hope is that obviously as coaches we've put the work into this point where they can make reads and they know where various scoring options are and those types of things, because like, I know there are times in games where I had it on Friday night. Like, I was adamant that our zone offense was not working well any time we just tried to walk the ball up the floor and hit the high post. It's like, any time we go to the short corner and then we have a dive and a lift situation, we get success. So stop throwing the ball into the high post. The next three possessions, we walk the ball down the floor and without a word of a lie, try and hit the high post.
And how'd you take that?
Oh, super well. Like, super well. As you can see, it's now 4 days later and I'm still slightly annoyed about it. But it's one of those things too where surely after the first time it's happened, we wouldn't go the second time. Surely after the second time, we wouldn't go a third time. After the third time, to be fair, there was a timeout in that situation. It was like, hey, I feel like we addressed this. It is one of those situations where I probably wasn't clear enough during our lead up to give them some alternatives too. So I don't hate the player because of it by any means. It's very much on me as a coach, as I think we all probably take these types of things a little bit personally, but it is one of those areas where it's like, oh, I'm pretty sure I said not to do that. You do have to give the players some ownership, but with that ownership, you still have to direct, I feel, in those offensive situations. So, I mean, when we're looking at things like special plays to get a designated score, and I know this is one of the things, like you spoke about your play card. I don't have a play card, but I do have some diagram stuff on the bottom of my whiteboard. So it's a Basketball Victoria whiteboard. You can get through the Basketball Victoria website for the low, low price of $8.99. to be honest, I don't know how much that costs, but contact me and I'll hook you up with something if I can. But it's got the full court on one side, it's got the half court on the other side, and then there's just a gap, sort of just some white underneath that you could normally write on. So for me, I've printed out a whole bunch of diagrams, and it's just a case of, look, if I need a quick two, that's what I'm running. If I need a three, that's what I'm going with. If I need to get something off a baseline, that's the play I would use, that sort of stuff. And it is there as front of mind more than anything else, because exactly like you, Coops, I'm getting older. I don't remember everything that I'm supposed to be doing. Like, I've got a team with like four players that have got similar names, and I still get that wrong after like 18 rounds. So it's an area where if I don't have to think about it, don't think about it. Like, you've got the play literally drawn up there. You can then just copy it with who you need in that space. So I think the play card type of thing is really important for those special plays, like, because we do need to have something in the bank from a sideline now. Just out of curiosity more than anything else, tight game. Actually, no, we won't go tight game. We'll go two-point game. Are you guys trying to go to overtime or are you trying to go to the three? And don't give me depends. That's boring. Like, I want a legitimate answer. Are you going the overtime or are you trying to stick that thing for the game winner, Coops?
I'm trying to play more basketball. Yep, I'm always about let's play more basketball. A lot of good data and analytics around the team that ties the game kind of has momentum, usually goes on to win it. So any chance that we can just play more ball, that's the option we're going to take.
Love it. What about you, Zoe?
Well, if I've got Steph Curry in my team, I'm going for the three. But other than that, more often than not, I'm going the two. I'll draw something up to have both options. Just because if obviously one's taken away, I think the worst thing we can do as coaches is only give one option for that, because if, especially with junior athletes, once that's taken away, they then almost all look at you like, okay, what do we do now? It's like four, five. So, but yeah, I'm more the safe, what I find is the safer option, the higher percentage shot.
So things you as coaches will need to be aware of, what's the foul count? Yeah. Like, know that if you are head on rim going downhill and the other team has fouls to give, they're probably going to give one.
Yeah.
So you have to be acutely aware of what the foul situation on that is. Obviously, time and score matters. One other thing, and we sort of touched on it a little bit before, is can your defense generate your offense? I know we're sort of circling back to the defensive change-ups, but if your offense isn't working, find a way to get some points in D. Like, whether it be junkie, whether it be up the floor, there's points on offer. Like, there are fast break points, there are slow down points, there are just some little broken play type points. And I find, oddly enough, it tends to be my players off my bench that are really good at getting those. I don't know why, but for some reason, my players coming off the bench are probably coming off the bench for a reason. So they probably may not run the play as well. They may break out of stuff a little bit more. So there's not quite that same level of trust as there is with the starting group. But those kids also have a little bit of a nose to try and find a score or get a hand in a passing lane or just come up with a little bit of a steal somewhere. So roll the dice on them a little bit. Like, everyone deals with game situations and anxiety a little bit differently. Like, you won't know if your players have something to offer if you never give them the chance to offer it. So trying to find different ways, different matchups, different lineups. Like, obviously, if you want something to work in a game, I would hope that you have used it at some point during the season.
Well, and I think too, defensively... offensively, if it's not working, if you're not executing well, you're not getting good looks, not 100% of the time, but more often than not, it's because someone's rushing somewhere. So, or, you know, they're rushing to a spot they shouldn't be, or they're crowding or doing because they're rushing to, or speeding up a little bit, trying to, you know, get their head on the rim or get their head to chase down an O-board or something like that. And it takes out your alignment, takes out your spacing, all that sort of stuff. So if you start to be more aggressive defensively, organically, that's going to tire out your team and slow them down. So offensively, then they can settle in. And I speak about it with the girls all the time about the certain types of pressure. So obviously you've got defensive pressure on the ball, then there's shot clock pressure, then there's scoreboard pressure. So, you know, if you're defending, and teams are just scoring on you, now all of a sudden that's going to put pressure on you at the offensive end, especially if you're going empty. So you've got to get that change up defensively, find the thing that's, like you said, just going to trigger some offense for you, just to keep the clock ticking over, the scoreboard ticking over, until you find your rhythm again.
So timeouts. This is the bit that we actually really enjoy as coaches, because everyone has to listen to us talk for a minute. Like, it is one of those areas. So are you scared to blow a timeout on top of a timeout? So when I say that, you've called a timeout, you've given direction or whatever the case may be, a minute and a half later, it's still not working. Are you one that is going to say, look, I'm not going to blow that because I don't want to lose my timeout? Like, we see it a fair bit, and I know I've been a victim, not a victim, but in this situation where I've blown a timeout early in the third quarter, it didn't adjust, had to blow a second timeout in the third quarter, which is like everyone gets all antsy. Whoa, you can't do that. And it's like, well, we needed it. Like, you don't get bonus points for finishing games with timeouts. So are you scared to do that? Would you try and hold on to it if you can? Like, I know coaches that sit there and say, I'm not calling any timeouts in the third quarter and then finish the game with like three timeouts. Coaches. And it's like, come on.
I love coaching against them. Like, we're pressing in the third.
But like, at what point do you sit there and say, hey, maybe I have to blow it? Like, would you be okay doing that, Coops?
I like to take it. Two timeouts into the clutch, you know, into that last kind of 2-3 minutes. That's important to me, knowing that I'm going to have, again, every opportunity to help the team from the sideline. That other timeout, I'm happy to use any point before that. I've used one before pretty quick after halftime. I think I've gone within a minute after halftime when we've lacked
execution. So halftime address went well?
Yeah, went really well, really stuck. So before I use that second timeout, again, I want to try a variety of things from the sideline, like can I connect with my point guard more regularly and give them some offensive looks or some help around the defense we're seeing or changing our defense, whatever that may be. Can I sub? You know, can I change my rotations? Can I impact the game that way? So I definitely want to try a variety of things before I get into that timeout. But at the end of the day, I've got to blow it, But I know for me, the clutch is important and those two timeouts are important to me in that part of the game.
Yep. What about you, Zoe?
Pretty much the same. So if I need it, I'll take it. And often if I've, you know, if I'm taking two timeouts in the third, you know, that's purely on feel. You know, you've got that, you get that, almost that feeling
might
in your
getting
stomach
away from
that, yeah, something's just getting away, either getting away from us or just not right, or I will try and, you know, impact through subbing or changing your defense or whatever that might be or whatever I need. And if that's just not working, well, then, yeah, you've got to go. Because like you said, you don't get extra points at the end of the game for holding on to timeouts.
So what about the other way? So if you haven't called a timeout in your third, you're getting to that magical 3-minute mark where you, if you have all three timeouts, you haven't used one, you lose it. Would you call it regardless?
No.
Yeah.
So if I'm a bit of a, I guess, believer, if I'm on paper the less talented team and I'm winning, let the game end. I'm not giving them time with their coach. So if they want their timeouts, they can burn theirs.
Yeah, so you're happy to lose one.
I'm happy to lose it, yeah. If you know, again, it's just on feel. I don't have a magic number. I don't have a, you know, I mean, maybe if I went back and looked, there may be some triggers that might align, but it's just based on feel. If I don't feel we need it, I'm not going to bring them to me, break our momentum, break their flow just so I can speak because I can. You know, it's going to be, hey, if they're getting the job done, we roll with.
Yep. So this is an area where you need to be on the same page with your assistant coach as well, because your assistant coach can save you in a lot of these situations. I was watching a game recently where momentum had started to shift a little bit. The team that was up but losing momentum called for a timeout. Game sort of continued for a little bit. Like, they probably still needed the timeout, but the ball went on out of court. The team that was making the run had the ball on their baseline, and the coach didn't cancel the timeout. So they gave the other team a free hit at it by calling their timeout. You have to be across that. The last thing you want to do is give a coach an opportunity to draw up a play, in particular if you've called the timeout to stop momentum, to then give them more momentum by allowing them to draw up a play.
And then set their D. You know, especially if it's a baseline out of bounds and, you know, there's a fairly high chance that they're going to run something for a score, then, you know, they're in a press or they're ready to set up with their defense. And basically, as a coach, we've handed them that.
Yep. It's one of those areas where don't give a sucker an even break. Yeah. Like, it's don't give them free timeouts to benefit themselves, I think.
Story time, Rob.
Ooh. Here we go, Coops. First one for season 7.
I was really lucky in kind of officially starting my VJBL coaching at Bulleen after I came back from college. I had a season or two at Sandringham, which was really enjoyable. Then I went away and came back. And part of that was the under 12 boys with Tom Maher. And so obviously that's a baptism of fire in terms of, you know, learning from one of the great, you know, coaches Australia has produced. And one of the things that I will always remember is we were playing Hawthorn, who were quite good at the time, and the opposition coach called a timeout when it was our ball on the baseline, and Tom just wheeled around to me, and like I'd called a timeout, he goes, "Don't ever call a timeout when it's the opposition's team on the baseline." And that is still ringing in my ears on the fact that I never want to give the opposition coach a freebie. I just cannot do it.
Yeah, exactly right. And that means so how you structure your timeout is of vital importance as well. And this is where I do recommend that coaches mic themselves up and listen to themselves back. And I know I'm an absolute victim of this. I bounce around everywhere. Like the first 10-ish seconds of my timeout is usually me venting about something that I'm unhappy with. And, you know, when my assistant coach does a great job, she gets me first so that I've got that 10 seconds out of the way so the players don't potentially have to hear it. So you do have to be really careful that you don't go from like offense to defense to offense to defense to offense when you're about to go out and play defense. Like, you want to finish on the thing that you're about to do next. So how much information is too much? Remembering that our kids probably only taking about 30% of what we say anyway. If we say that we're going to be in zone on this next possession, but we're going to be in switching man on the one after that, you're going to have half your team in zone and half your team in switching man. Yeah. And, you know, we've all seen how that plays out. So how you structure your timeout in that space is really important to make sure that you are calm. The ranting, irate, vein-popping coach, that just puts fear in the kids. They don't hear anything. Like, they're just hoping that it's not them that gets chewed out. Like, so you have to be very mindful about how you address that. Calm, clear, concise, take a breath, then go and deliver the message from there.
Yeah, and it's that, you know, 3 points. Yep. You know, it's depending on the age. But 3 points max. I think I've told this story on this pod before, but
do you want the
story time?
Yeah, okay, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So my first season ever coaching Friday night basketball, my niece's team, the under 12, I want to say fives, and I'm in this timeout and I'm in my head crushing it. Like, I'm on the board, I've got all these points. The girls look like they're looking at me and they're nodding away, and here I am, I'm like, this is outstanding. Like, how good is this? And I'm like, right, hands in. So we do our hands in. And then my niece stands up, who's about to go on the court, and says, "Auntie Zoe, have you had your nails done?" And it was in that moment I went, yeah. They went, everything I said, I gave them far too many points, and they've now listened to none of them because it was just information overload because I wanted to hear the sound of my own voice. So those three, and, you know, we're coaches, so we're designed to see what needs to be fixed, and there's always a lot that needs to be fixed. So there could be 6 or 7 things we could talk about in a timeout. Pick the 3 most important, and as Rob said, finish on the one you're about to go do, and, you know, then try and attack the other points sort of throughout with your rotations or with how you change your defense or whatever that might be. But, yeah, making sure that we don't overload because, as Rob said, they're listening to maybe 30%, and in my niece's case, 0. So, you know, to get bang for your buck and to actually see transfer, just keep it simple.
Yeah, I can remember a few of them from NBL1 just gone, that my best timeouts were when I was locked in enough to not only keep it to 3 punchy points, but also that I would repeat those 3 on the way out. So give them the detail that I felt they could take on, and then we'd finish the timeout by repeating them back in even a more punchy. So we're in A, B, C, and that's the last 3 things they hear going back out. And I always felt confident going out of the timeout if I'd done that correctly.
And it's really important as assistant coaches, I believe, that the last voice they hear is the head coaches. So I often see especially if they're in the clutch, because again, it's coming from a good place. I'm certainly not, I guess, accusing anyone of anything. But you often see when we're in the when games are in the clutch, assistant coaches are trying to deliver more information. The information that's come from the head coach, or the messaging that has come from the head coach, needs to be the last thing they hear. So you can reiterate what the coach has said, or if they ask, you can answer. But going and adding to the message is counterproductive.
Yep, makes sense. So hopefully at the end of all that, you're ahead by at least 1 point at the end of the game, but sometimes you're not. And the message you deliver to your athletes, I mean, this could be a season-ending loss. It could be whatever the case may be. At the end of the day, the sun will come up tomorrow. Like, I think it's really important that regardless of how it goes, you end on a positive message with that. Like, you may be shattered and heartbroken, all that sort of stuff, but similar to what both of you have said throughout the course of this, the win and the loss doesn't define you as a coach or your players as people. So it is vitally important that you do send them away in a really positive mindset. We want as many kids playing the sport, and we don't want that to be a real negative feel about everything that's going on in that space. So just be really diligent with that. If you can, go over things, obviously, with film and whatever the case may be. That's always a great way to do it, so that there is some continual learning for your athletes. You don't want to just say, hey, that sucked, and catch you guys Sunday. Like, you want to give them a little bit more than that, but understanding that emotions are usually fairly heightened after game as well. So we do have to be super conscious of that. Any other last points, Coops, you got on this one?
Maybe just from experience around those last, you know, one or two timeouts, especially with the modern game, and probably those coaches, 16s, 18s and above, you got to prepare for the switch. So if you are drawing something up, the likelihood of a switch everything defense coming from the opposition coach is going to be pretty high. So have that in the forefront of your mind when you're drawing up those last plays. And then the other one that ties back into what you guys were saying was about that foul situation. So we've used our last timeout, but they have, you know, one or two fouls to give. What are we doing on that next side ball after that first foul or the subsequent foul? You know, do we have a different wrinkle? Are we running the same play? We definitely want to have that ability to think two or three steps ahead.
Yep. So, anything more?
Actually, a couple. So, sorry.
Righto.
So, always be mindful of the foul count, especially in the clutch. Don't be afraid to foul. So if you've got them to give, especially if a team has called a timeout to advance the ball and setting something up, you know, they've got maybe over 10 seconds and you're up, say, three, don't be afraid to foul them. And even if you're in the bonus as well, you know, send them to the line. They can only get two. Now you're in control. As well as, you know, if you've got them to give, disrupt what they're about to run. Either you're forcing them into burning another timeout, or if they're out of timeouts, now they've got to make something up on the run. And again, that's just a way of impacting the game. It can blow up in your face. I'm not saying it's 100% foolproof, but it is a way of impacting the game, and again, forcing those decisions to be made in high pressure. The other thing I would say is, we don't have a lot of opportunities as coaches to coach in those situations, because they don't come up really all that often. So I would encourage coaches to do a couple of things. One, get out to as many, either whether it's a senior coach or a coach in your program, you know, a respected coach within your program, sit behind their bench, watch what they do, listen to what they say, you know, just broaden your experience and broaden your, I guess, knowledge of, you know, how people deal with certain situations, as well as put yourselves in those situations as well. So, you know, if you happen to have 10 turn up to practice, you know, yeah, I know it's odd.
Yeah,
it's odd.
Look, to be fair, we are on a podcast and there is no video, but there was the most significant eye roll from me that has ever been seen. If the earth just tilted, it was not an earthquake. It was me rolling my eyes at having 10 people turn up for practice.
But don't use your whole session for this, but, you know, carve out a small, if it's a 15-minute window where, okay, one team's up by X amount, however long on the clock, and it's on you to draw something up or to make some decisions and put yourself into those positions, because they are quite daunting when you're in it, when it actually matters. So if we talk about games approach coaching to help our athletes already know or have already seen what's about to happen, we need to do the same thing as coaches. And like I said, the opportunity for 1-point games, 2-point games and all these scenarios, that they don't really come up all that often. So, yeah, putting ourselves in that position as often as possible, or if you've got a, you know, you can grab the second team or something or third team or whatever and train with them and do some stuff. I think, you know, we are so athlete focused and that's how it should be. But to be athlete focused, we have to be the best we can be. So we've got to get ourselves to the level to be able to make those decisions as well. Because, yeah, like I said, they can be overwhelming. So, yeah, that would just
quick
be
quick one without notice, Coops. 3-point game, you're on defense. Foul or defend?
I like to foul.
Foul?
Yep.
Zoe?
How long's to go?
Last possession.
Oh, last possession.
Stop trying to pick the eyes out of this thing. Just answer the damn question. No, I'm joking. Like,
sorry. Sorry, I'm 3-point.
You're 3 points up.
Up?
Yep, you're I'll on foul. Defense. I you're fouling? Foul. Yeah, yep. Same. Okay, so you need to be across that, coaches, and your team needs to be across what's happening because you may not have the timeout to be able to tell them. And the last thing you want to be doing is screaming out across the court, foul, because now, one, everyone knows that you're going to foul, so they're going to try and shoot that thing as best they possibly can. Starts to bring the referees in the game, whether that's a deliberate foul, and that's the last thing you need to be giving up an unsportsmanlike in that situation as well. So if you have a rule, that's fine, but make sure your players know what that rule is.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you can't change halfway through because, you know, that's the beauty of coaching. But, you know, at least have a rule and a little bit of a philosophy as to what you're going to do. Coaches, that does wrap us up. So if you are in the land of finals, congratulations. Good luck for it as you churn through those next couple of weeks of the season. If you're out of finals, enjoy the off-season, coaches. Yeah. Like, it's... This is a great time to decompress, but also go get some PD in. So it's a really good thing if you can go and get on the podcast, if you can go and get on in books and all those kinds of things as well. We are looking to have a resource show in a few weeks' time as well. We are going to churn through every book Coops has read over like 2 lockdowns in the last year. So strap in. That could be about 2 hours 30. But we are going to try and throw some things out that we've enjoyed reading as well. So it is a good time of year to get that done. Listeners, if you can like, share, retweets, rate, review, subscribe, and probably 15 other things I haven't thought of in that situation. That would be fantastic. We are looking forward to coming back next week where we will try and talk through all things Australian Junior Championships from 2016 to 18s this year. So Zoe, you're going to get the week off. Coops, you are back on deck.
Fantastic.
And we'll be dragging Bestie back in here too. So coaches, good luck if you're in finals. If not, like I said, enjoy the PD and we'll catch you guys next week. Look, tune in, enjoy the try on